Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timory.
We've been pretty hard on Netflix here on the show, Timory, and, you know, I think a lot of times they deserve it, but I do want to give credit where credit is due. Sometimes they air some good programming, and let me give a shout-out to a new Netflix show that I think you should go check out. It's called Liberating a Continent, John Paul II and the Fall of Communism. New on Netflix.
Is it made by Netflix or airing on Netflix?
I do not believe it's made by Netflix. It's airing on Netflix. It's narrated by Jim Caviezel, who is one of our favorite Catholics in Hollywood.
I love him.
Yeah. So check that out on Netflix. You know, speaking of Netflix, interesting interview with the person who runs Netflix recently, Reed Hastings. He's the CEO. And he was talking about who they are competing with. And you might think, well, HBO, Amazon, you know, Redbox. I don't know. Who does Netflix compete with? The big networks? No, check
this
out.
Does Redbox even exist anymore?
Of course Redbox exists.
I mean, it's been years. We aren't even friends anymore.
You can walk down there, pay your dollar. I use it for my kids.
Okay.
Because it's very close by. We can literally walk and get the little DVD.
And pick it up.
And it's still cheaper than, you know, $3.99 digital download
okay,
or whatever.
Okay, that makes sense.
So for the super cheap flick that I don't want to buy or pay any more for,
you get the DVD version. I must just be really lazy, Don. But also, I mean, most places don't have a DVD port. I mean, I finally bought a TV, but usually I just watch on my computer.
Well, see, you're exactly right about that. I mean, you're the classic millennial, though, Timory. I mean, now you can barely get your computers. They're not even coming with anything. It's not that they're coming, not even with a USB. It's craziness. No, the DVD thing, I mean, we're pretty old school. We even, not that we ever use this, but the VCR is still available in our house. So,
But when you have all those videos, sometimes it's tough to get rid of them. But I remember making bank selling those in a yard sale, getting rid of
Did
all
you?
Our VHSs.
Your Disney?
Yes.
Some of those Disney VHSs are worth a lot of money, and we found that out after we did the whole garage sale. So somebody probably made off with a large amount of valuable merchandise. All right, so here's what Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, said. We are competing with sleep. That's what he's competing with, he said. When you watch a show from Netflix, you get addicted, and you stay up late, and you binge watch. And that's what they do, right? They don't put out one episode every week. You have to wait. No, they're going to throw out all 13 or all whatever.
It's awesome. It's available at once to watch at your leisure.
Now, do you do the binge watching? Do you just like, I'm going to watch this whole season?
There are definitely times where I struggle. However, for me, a huge part of Lent was actually disconnecting from watching TV shows, Netflix and everything, and reading.
Okay, well, yeah, that's awesome. And did that go well?
Yes, very much so. I'll just tell you, I now only have two shows that I'm watching. So this is like maybe an hour and a half a week. And
very,
you know,
nice.
I watch them while I fold my laundry. It's something to do. It's playing in the background. It's not a matter of just watching it to watch it.
Right.
And I'm loving reading.
That's incredible. Now, I can't imagine binge watching because to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't you need like a pretty big block of time to try to, if I'm going to watch a whole season over a weekend, that means I'd actually have to be sitting in front of the television for several hours at one time. And of course, we have four kids, you know, youngest is six, oldest is 16. That's not going to happen. I'm sharing with you. If we watch something, it's like my wife and I finally, you know, crash on the couch at 10:45 PM and we're like, all right, can we get in a 22 minute something before we fall asleep completely? You're not. There's no binge watching in our house, but I get it. But what's interesting to me is that he understands that as an entertainment commodity, we're really wanting every single second of your day. Like, I don't just want that extra time you have. I want you to make a concerted effort to make time for me. I'm going
to
take it from
sleep. And put it on my calendar.
Yeah, absolutely. Sleep or work. And the guy who wrote this article mentioning this, he points out that it does seem to indicate maybe a shift in the way we as a culture view entertainment, where now it's like we do put the entertainment on the calendar rather than work, right? Like in the past, we would, all right, I'm going to rest now so that I can get up and work and make a living and provide for my family or whatever it is, right? Like leisure was something that had a recuperative thing where it helped your real life, if you will. Like yes. The important things in life. It helped you do those because you could get a little bit of rest.
Well, it was viewed, yeah, exactly. It was viewed as rest. And I think I see a lot of the problem that we struggle with media is that it's like, man, I haven't even gotten to watch a show all week. As if it's something that like we deserve, that we should be doing, that there's something wrong with my rest schedule if I haven't even gotten to watch TV this week.
Well, and when we do work, I get the sense that we are working just so we can get that binge watching time or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm all right, I'm putting in my hours, but it's only so I can pay for my Netflix and the big TV and spend my weekend binge watching the latest thing. Like that's why I'm here making money, so that I can go be entertained. And that, I think, is exactly the opposite of how we used to approach all of this, right? Like, here I am, I'm going to rest for a while so that I can go do my real work. Whereas now the real work is being entertained. Like, this is what we are all about. Like, I'm going to take time from work or sleep or whatever it is.
But it is exhausting when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you keep looking, thinking, I need to just shut this off. Why am I still watching? But I want to know what happens next. And, you know, it's different. You're sitting here forcing yourself to stay awake, but also the screen draws you in a little bit more than, say, when I stay up all night reading.
Well, and reading will help you sleep, actually.
I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
Usually reading will help you sleep. I mean, think about how many people they knock out and they have a book on top of them. I sometimes will get so wrapped in that I want to stay up, but I actually have more control with saying no when I have the book in front of me than if I just sit there with my iPad and keep watching.
Yeah, right. Let me ask you a seemingly unrelated question, but I'm going to try to tie this in. We'll see if I can accomplish this. Have you got your jeans from Nordstrom's that already have the mud all over them? Did you see that?
What?
Yeah. Nordstrom, here you go. I'll hand you the article right here. Nordstrom is selling pre-soiled jeans.
What?
They come all caked in some
real
sort
dirt?
Of... Well, I think
I'm
it's some sort
for
of...
real dirt?
Yeah, I think it's some sort of synthetic
dirt. Hold on. Okay. This reminds me, one of the big things growing up is... My mom would always say, we can't get ripped jeans. She already just thought, why would we get jeans with them?
Exactly. I tried
with
to not.
Holes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But my dad was like really big. Why would you get a pair of jeans that already have holes in them? You know, you're just ruining your clothes before you even
well, of
use
course,
them.
This is the common sense approach to this. Like, again, I grew up on a farm. We're looking at the picture of these jeans, right? And they're just dirty. I know what it's like to wear those jeans, but not because we've got some sort of fake synthetic dirt on them, but actual dirt. Well, here's the thing. Those were work jeans. We would try to get them as clean as possible and wear them the next day, but we had different things when we went out in public, right? So if you're going to go to town or you're going to go to church, I'm not going to wear these dirty, ripped jeans.
It'd be disrespectful.
Yeah, exactly. And what is going on in the culture that now we're going to spend $425. That's what they want at Nordstrom's for these jeans.
$425. It's disrespectful, too. It disrespects the fact that when people have dirty jeans, it's maybe because they can't afford a different pair of jeans or they've worked really hard. It's the end of their day, and there's a dignity, in a sense, to those jeans of someone who worked hard.
That's what Mike Rowe, you know, the guy from Dirty Jobs, his take was that he's like, you're actually sort of disrespecting the people who are working hard. You, who don't seem to be, you're like playing at working, it seems like.
Yes.
Like you're not out there doing manual labor, but you're willing to spend $425 for something that the person who's actually out there getting dirty would never, I mean, he couldn't conceive of paying that much money for clothes. So it is disrespectful. I have another take, not that I don't agree with that, but what if that part of the notion of wearing jeans that look like they've been worked in, is it perhaps a callback to a time when more people actually had meaningful work?
Mm.
Like maybe there's a lot of people out there that look at their work and they say, this is not meaningful. Whatever it is I'm doing, I could not do it and the world would not change at all and my life would not change at all. I'm just killing time here. I'm killing time before I can go watch Netflix or whatever, right? And perhaps and I don't have the scientific studies on this, but I think that's perhaps a callback to a time when we actually had work that we could look at and say, oh, you know, look at that field of grain that I grew.
Or I built that house.
Yeah, look, exactly. Look
at that
house.
The trade element of things.
Absolutely, right? The trades, which have been so denigrated for the past.
It's unfortunate.
Absolutely, it's unfortunate. And this is what Mike Rowe's all about, too, with his Dirty Jobs campaign, is that, listen, this is meaningful work. And indeed, when people don't have that, there is a void that exists where if they were out there doing something more meaningful, that void would not be there. In fact, studies on middle-aged men, you know, well, what are you after in life? Relationships and meaningful work. That's the two mm-hmm. things we want. We want love and we want work that has meaning. Mm-hmm. Give us that, and as men, we're fine.
Well, and I think, and this is what we've talked about this a lot on here, work recently, and I look at this in a couple different ways. You have a trade, you have, you know, construction, you have whatever it is. You see the fruit of your labor in a house, in a field, like you said. Well, a lot of our jobs today are effective, they are helpful, but we don't see the fruit of the labor because we are just one of the cogs in the whole machine of the impact, in a sense.
Right.
And I think that that's where we become a little disconnected. But if we can see that our work isn't just necessarily, I mean, we're not all going to do super meaningful things, but there is meaning to working and providing for your family, giving the opportunity and care for them that they need so that you guys can have that family life.
Yeah, it's part of how we're made, right? Like God made us to have meaningful work. He put Adam and Eve over the garden to go and work and have responsibilities. When we lose that, when that's missing from our worldview, when we just see life as essentially meaningless, we lose a lot more than initially we might have thought. All right, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timory. We'll be right back.
From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending.
Trending
with Don and Timory, applying timeless principles to today's hottest topics.
So, Don, as the controversy stirs over the transgender movement, I think the most important conversation taking place has to do with children and what we're allowing to take place based on this movement over gender. The bottom line is that children shouldn't be at the heart of it. Anything that's taking place with a changing, a mutilating of the body, transitioning over to a different sex, should really, at least if it's going to happen, wait until much later, at least entering into that period of time where the body continues to finish out some of its development, especially in the area of the brain in the, like around the mid-20s. That being said, what's interesting is that some studies, I think, are becoming so politicized in a sense. We see this with something that came out from the American Academy of Pediatricians.
Yeah, well, the study, which was just released in the April Journal of Experimental Psychology, comes out with something that you might think is pretty much common sense. And they report that children under the age of 14 are not capable of crossing a busy street because, quote, they lack the perceptual judgment and physical skills needed to consistently get across safely. Now, I don't know if I'd push it to 14, but as a father of kids, I know that I do not let my little small children go and run across the street. I mean, this is common sense. Children, they run out there. They're not looking around them, seeing where the car is coming. If they're really small, they don't even realize necessarily that, oh, that car is going to run down really fast on the street and mm-hmm. crush you if you're out there, right? And so as a parent, you put rules in place. You're going to hold my hand when we cross the street. You are going to wait and look both ways as you get older. By yes. the time they're 14, I'll admit, yes, I let them cross the street by themselves. But you get what the pediatric association here, you get what they're saying,
yes.
right? Like, yeah, okay. Now, what the American College of Pediatricians is pointing out is, on the other hand, that same group, the one that just told you to wait till your kids are 14 before letting them cross the street.
Based on cognitive reasoning.
right. That same group says, oh yeah, go ahead and have the sex change stuff when they're 4 or 5 or whatever. Like, on what planet does that make sense?
So, and then this is where we can kind of just solidify that this becomes so polarized and focusing on an agenda of this gender revolution agenda. We have President Dr. Critella from the American College of Pediatricians who's criticizing this new comment. And she's basically noting there's a reason that things such as voting, driving, joining the military, drinking alcohol, all of these things have age requirements based on cognitive reasoning and limitations. The same should at least be acknowledged when we're talking about such a deep thing as changing from something that's different from your existence as male or female. You can't change your existence, but you can manipulate body parts and create chemicals in your body that block puberty and prevent you from developing as a man biologically or as a female.
I'm always astounded in dealing with pediatricians how quickly they are to want to offer some of these hormonal drugs.
It's yes.
Craziness. I mean, really? You want to put synthetic hormones in my kid? No, I don't think that's going to happen. I've actually dealt with that as a parent, and you're like, wow. I mean, you're quick with that stuff. Now, you brought up a great point earlier, Timory, that, you know, the sexual revolution as a whole, not just with things like the sex change, gender fluidity, all that stuff,
yes.
but really all elements of the sexual revolution have been devastating to children.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, they
God.
Have paid the price time after time. And, I mean, of course, you can just look at all of the ones we've killed, all right? I mean, that's
yes.
obviously that's the big one, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
but look,
millions.
It wasn't a fully grown adult on the front of the National Geographic. It was a child in January, a child who they've transitioned.
Unbelievable. You know, even you don't even have to go with some of the more major ones. You can even just look at what is the price that kids are paying when it comes to things like in vitro fertilization?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, there are recent studies coming out talking about this right now as well. There's a really good one from Israeli, which in a sense is the first of its kind, published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, showed the first study where you followed a group of children conceived through IVF, so created outside of the womb and implanted into the woman. What's the long-term impact going into their adulthood? Well, they did this study taking into consideration and setting aside, so removing cases where, say, the child was born prematurely or where the child had a low birth rate. Guess what they saw? Children who were born through IVF were 3 times more likely to suffer from cancer and tumors.
Wow.
Three times more likely. And again, that is including, just in case we want to argue that part of it might have to do with premature birth or right. lightweight, they took those out. So that's removing even something that could be participating in this as well.
Wow. It reminds me of the birth control pill stats as far as how they damage women.
Yes.
You look at the stats, just the physical stats. This is just science, right?
Yes.
We're just looking at the data. How many kids get this condition after they have been whatever, or how many women? And it's very clear that all of these things have been very bad for children and for women. Yet you're right. The ideology blinds people or something to seeing the effects.
Well, and this is something we're not hearing talked about enough. So we talk about the pill and its impact, like you said, with synthetic versions of estrogen and progesterone being pumped into the woman's body that are causing, estrogen and progesterone in their synthetic form are group 1 carcinogens. Well, when you go through in vitro fertilization, your body as a woman is pumped with some of the highest levels of synthetic hormones. Higher, it's like birth control super version.
Hmm.
And the woman's body and how it reacts is extremely painful, unhealthy. I mean, I could share with you stories. There's a great one on Verily magazine about a woman and her experience that she says she knows a lot of other women who have gone through. And here's what happens when you're conceiving a child, creating their earliest moments of life with high levels of synthetic hormones. You're surrounding that little body with group 1 carcinogens through the pregnancy. No wonder they're now showing high levels of cancer in their later years. They were already exposed.
So carcinogens, when I think of that, I think of like smoking,
mm-hmm.
right?
Cigarettes.
And so it would be like smoking cigarettes. I mean, I'm sure it's a different type of thing.
It's a cancer-causing agent.
But cancer-causing agents, like you partaking of all of these cancer-causing agents as a pregnant woman,
yes,
right? And we rightly look down, I think. Hey, if you're pregnant, hey, stop so much drinking. Stop your smoking.
Don't
That's
even
not
dye
good.
Your hair, paint
right,
your nails.
Right, all of this stuff. Don't put that in your body because you're hurting the baby. Yet, we're going to do the hormones.
So not only are we exposing the pregnant woman, but we're then exposing these babies just through the way they're being conceived.
Right.
And that's a real concern. You know, we could go on and on about the lack of dignity of the creation of that human person through IVF. I mean, even Elton John, who has had multiple donor-conceived children now, was in his late 60s when he had them. By the time one of his children graduates, his older one graduates, Elton John will be 81 years old.
But if he makes it. So yeah, this is an interesting element to this whole story.
But even he said, Don, he said, well, I'm really sad and it's heartbreaking to think about my children finding out one day and realizing that they'll never have a mommy. They don't have one.
Yeah, not only are they not going to have a mommy, they're not going to have a dad. Because he's sick right now. He's in the hospital,
yes,
and the kids are very young right now. So yeah,
they're
like
very,
you said,
very young.
Yeah.
Yes, I think about 7 and 5, essentially.
So we've talked about some of the physical effects of separating sex from
marriage and family.
Exactly. But the emotional and psychological issues we haven't even touched on, and this speaks to one. Here's Elton John, who's mm-hmm. going to be super old. This is not just among homosexual couples either, right?
No, it's not. It's very prominent within that community.
Absolutely it is.
But we're seeing it in our own churches. I mean, there are a couple churches in San Diego where we've had these women celebrating, oh, I just had another baby. We have another child. And there's like a sibling rivalry going on with a couple of families that I can think of right now where they keep having more and more children, but they keep going and having a child through a surrogate mother. And then they go and pick up the baby and it's this competition who can have more kids.
Well, and how old? I mean, what's the age level? You talked about yeah. adoption. You know, when we adopt kids out, we have rules in place where we don't adopt kids to older families.
We don't. We have huge restrictions through adoption agencies, making sure these kids aren't placed in harmful environments, harmful relationships, that they're not being adopted just to work. They're not being adopted, like you said, by old parents.
I mean, how devastating is it for a young person, maybe in their teens, to have a parent die when you're 13, mm-hmm. 14? And that's much more likely. And that's just, I mean, that's just a simple fact. It's one of the reasons God set it up. So, you know, your prime time for having kids was when you're young and full of energy.
Yes.
I mean, I'm older too. It's like I had kids somewhat older, but I can't imagine when you're 60 and trying to have an infant. So.
Well, there's a reason for when you're able to have children, you're younger, you're supposed to be creating a family with a mother and a father. There's a reason that's how these children come into existence. Yet, for example, adoption, we're recognizing there is an absence. Maybe a mother was missing, maybe a father, an unhealthy circumstance. This child had to be placed for adoption. Well, we should then be trying to provide the best possible circumstances for the child. It's not about the parents. It's about the whole family.
Yeah, the sexual revolution has been a disaster for children. It's one more example of, hey, maybe God had it right when he set things up and we're messing things up. All right, we'll be right back after this short break. Stick around.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. This is Trending with Don and Timmery on Immaculate Heart Radio. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit donjohnsonministries.org or timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
Timmery, do you consider yourself a fan of spiritual bloggers? Do you read any bloggers consistently that you go to for spiritual insight, biblical commentary, any sort of thing like that?
I'm more of a book person, but I've definitely seen some of the fruits coming from the blogosphere right now in terms of the incredible, I think, information. But also, there's a lot of content out there in terms of spiritual blogs anymore.
A lot of content.
A lot of content. There's definitely a lot to sift through.
And some really high quality stuff.
Yes.
I mean, maybe some not so high quality, but I know my wife is a big fan of several spiritual bloggers. She reads things like She Reads Truth,
yes,
which is an app that brings in insight from all sorts of women. And then they produce these hard copies of things, too, for different
wow.
seasons.
But you have the groups like some of the Catholic groups going on. You mentioned earlier when we were talking, Blessed Is She. You have also one of the new ones that's launching is the Endow Groups. They have the studies for the parishes, but they've now launched Endow Voices, so blogs. Actually, I have one coming out next week with them.
Oh, okay. Nice. Where can we find that?
Endow Voices, Endow. I think the Endow website's just endow.com. I should
okay.
probably double check. But if you look up Endow, any of the women's groups, they'll have their new part, Endow Voices.
We talked to the founder of Blessed Is She, which is also
yes.
My wife's a big fan of her. She actually called into the Patrick Madrid show when I hosted on last week. So, yeah, a lot of wonderful things. Now, a very interesting article about this phenomenon in Christianity Today this last week. By Tish Harrison Warren. And it caught my eye because the headline is, Who's in Charge of the Christian Blogosphere? Mm. And she points out that since the early 2000s, the spiritual blogger has brought comfort to many, many households. Lay people have suddenly become household names, and they wield influence over tens of thousands of followers. In fact, it's produced a new kind of Christian celebrity. And I know that there's conferences all around the country where you can go
yes.
and, you know, hear from
speakers talking on these incredible, I mean, things that they're sharing on, from how to be a good parent to how do you find our Lord through the sacrifice of motherhood or being in the workforce, whatever it might be.
And these people have huge followings. It's a multi-million dollar industry now. So it's like a lot of people, a lot of money, big things happening. But Miss Warren here is concerned that there is a lack of authority within this movement. And she points to the recent example of popular blogger Jen Hatmaker. And Jen Hatmaker, especially in the evangelical world, is about as big as she could get,
yes.
at least until recently. And then suddenly she came out as supporting so-called gay marriage, right? She came out with a pro same-sex attraction marriage stance. Mm. And as you might expect, this caused some concern among some of her followers. But it raised the question for our author here in Christianity Today, well, who exactly has authority over us and over Miss Hatmaker?
This is an excellent question, especially as we're sifting through what do we read, what don't
exactly.
we read.
Exactly. She says, hey, male church leaders still often derive their authority from theological education, ordination, institutions. But women, she says, less often have that sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, Timory, you're a blogger and you've got the MA in theology, so you've got a little educational credential. However, she says, often it's simply due to being a good speaker and a good teacher, mm-hmm. and there isn't much authority behind this.
She's basically pointing out, I think, an important thing as we're going through this, and that is, you know, I do see this even within the Catholic speaking and Catholic blogosphere as well. You have incredible people sharing things on human sexuality, on parenting, on scripture. But then you also should always have, for Catholics, this consistency there, right? Which is what you're pointing to.
Well, yeah, there should be a consistency that derives from submitting yourself
to the
authority of the church.
Exactly.
Now, that's actually what this author, who is a Protestant, calls for. She says, what you need to do as a spiritual blogger is find your church to submit to. And here, listen to this. The New Testament presupposes that church authority, hierarchy, and discipline exist to protect orthodoxy and orthopraxy, so right thinking and right acting. This responsibility does not cease in this age of internet. Orthodox church institutions that value scriptural and historical faithfulness have a responsibility to provide clear guidance to Christian readers and listeners who are seeking to discern which voices to heed in the din of cyber spirituality. And I'm like, hold on. You're exactly right on that, but you're an Anglican. Like,
come into the church, well, my dear.
On what? Basically, what you're saying is, well, okay, yeah, you got to go submit to your church. Well, hold on. All that does is push it back one more level. Which church?
Yes.
Which church do I need to submit to? And you're correct. Yes.
Well, we're seeing a lot of the Anglicans coming in the church now, in a good partnership, thanks to Pope Benedict and his incredible work, Pope Emeritus Benedict, drawing the Anglican church
now,
in.
Anglicans are pretty high church, pretty high authority. They're very close to Catholics. But lest we forget, they did split off from the Catholic Church over a dispute about divorce. Okay. a very flimsy reason to split from the true church.
Well, and this is what we're seeing, I would say, even in the Christian blogosphere and Christian speakers. And I actually have to say, even with a lot of our very talented Catholic speakers right now, I think that sometimes we also have a strong responsibility to not only keep them accountable to the church's teaching, but accountable to a continued development as well. Because, I mean, we have to come in with a level of deep understanding. We can't just be an expert on the Bible and have no formal training on the Bible.
Okay,
and what are we,
here's my question though, is like, well, and you know this, but what are we keeping them accountable to?
Yes, right? And that's where the church is so clear, whether it's moral theology, biblical theology, systematic theology, ecclesiology. There are branches within theology in the church that are very clear in the church's teaching. There's not room for suddenly a recreation of doctrine. You can have a development of doctrine that already exists to clarify it, but no new teaching for the salvation of souls is coming about.
No, exactly. The Catholic Church has that built in, right? Like, we claim we come from the apostles. Jesus granted that authority them, and it has been passed down. We have apostolic succession. The Eastern Orthodox make that same claim. Here's the thing, though, with Protestants. You don't make that claim. You're not even there to make the claim that we as a church have authority. Your authority is supposed to be sola scriptura. Like, you don't actually have within Protestantism the setup to even appeal to any sort of local church body. And if you do make this appeal, like this author in Christianity Today did, let's say you do make that appeal. Yeah, you've got to submit to the authority. Well, what are you submitting to then? Are you submitting to Henry VIII? Are you submitting to the founder of your local denomination? Are you submitting to Harriet Beecher Stowe or whoever? Yes. You know, like, which person are you submitting to? A lot of times, what you're going to do is, if you decide to submit to your local churches, you're going to submit to the ideas of your local pastor.
That mission statement, that pastor,
exactly,
whatever he says, who can change at any point in time, which we're seeing with popular bloggers.
Absolutely,
right now.
Right? And so it's not enough to just say, well, you got to have something other than your personal opinion.
Yes.
Of course you do. But ultimately, you have to base your authority in the one true church.
In its magisterium, which makes up scripture and tradition together. And again, we've got to emphasize this so deeply. We have the fullness of truth. Nothing new is going to be revealed that is necessary for our salvation. Even as we come up on the 100th anniversary of Fatima.
Absolutely.
That wasn't necessary for us to be able to be with God or come to know him. It's certainly a gift and something that's recognized by the church, but it wasn't necessary.
We're also coming up on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And so for all of my Protestant brothers and sisters, here's all I'd ask. When you make that appeal to some sort of authority, what is that? You know, Hank Hanegraaff, I don't know if you're familiar with the Bible Answer Man, very big deal in Protestant circles. Just before Easter on Palm Sunday, he became Eastern Orthodox. And this, as you might suspect, caused some consternation in certain evangelical circles. I mean, this is a guy who knows his Bible as well or better than, you know, almost anyone in the world. Like, he's called the Bible Answer Man for a reason. And here he is ceasing to be Protestant.
He's stepping closer and closer into the hierarchy of the church.
Not
quite
say.
Here,
he's not
but
there yet, but I think that's a step in the right direction.
Come on over.
But what I don't quite get is all of the Protestants who say to guys like Hank Hanegraaff, oh, well, you've left the authority of Scripture. Actually, he has not.
He's
right?
following the path of Scripture.
Well, he's following Scripture where he thinks it leads, but guess what? There is no such thing as the authority of Scripture. Like, ultimately, all that means is somebody's personal interpretation. The point I'm trying to make with this woman who's saying, hey, you spiritual bloggers out there, submit yourself. All she is saying is submit yourself to somebody's interpretation of the text.
Exactly.
And that's not good enough.
And just to be clear, too, with regard to Eastern Orthodox, we're speaking in good terms toward the Eastern Orthodox because they do follow a little closer than many forms of Protestantism to some of these, toward the sacramentality of the church and toward the structure where we would see that, you know, in order to be a priest, a bishop, a cardinal, and so forth, you have that handing on from one to the other through the bishops. At a certain point within the Eastern churches, they broke off, but we do see that they do tend to be more consistent.
Yeah, absolutely. It's they're a much different deal than Protestantism, than the Reformers. Yeah, it is.
Not that they're in full communion.
No, but it is a different type of split.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And many people make their journey to Catholicism through the Eastern churches.
Absolutely.
Especially because a lot of time they're struggling with the Pope. It's a big one for people.
The Pope is a big one. Okay, we're going to go to a quick break. During this break, don't forget to check out DonJohnsonMinistries.org and Timory.com. You can invite us to speak and learn more about all of the various things that we do when we're not hosting radio shows.
Timory and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Don and Timory, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Were you on social media during that break? And if so, did you check out Timory's many pages? Timory, where can they find you?
You can find me at Timory, that's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E, on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I am there.
And you know, there aren't many breaks in my life, I'm loath to admit, that I don't go and quickly check my phone. It's one of those terrible things. I
gotta get connected with us.
Break myself of that. But yes, if you're going to be on your phone, go ahead and connect with us.
Jump on board. And I actually tweet out a lot of the articles from the shows as well. So if you're ever curious, oh, I'd like to dive deeper or find the statistic that they mentioned, I tweet out a lot of the articles during and after the show.
There you go. Interesting story from former President Jimmy Carter this week. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about Protestantism and some of the issues there. Well, you may know Jimmy Carter has been a Sunday school teacher for most of his life. However, this past week, he said he is now leaving the Southern Baptist Convention after 6 decades. Here's what he says. I've been a practicing Christian all my life and a deacon and a Bible teacher for many years. My faith is a source of strength and comfort to me, as religious beliefs are to hundreds of millions of people around the world. So my decision to sever my ties with the Southern Baptist Convention was painful and difficult. This is after 6 decades, right? He's been,
wow.
And I'm like, and here's why. Before we start to question what he's thinking here, here's why. He says that it was unavoidable now because the convention's leaders, he's talking about the Southern Baptist now, quoting a few selected Bible verses, basically demean women. They say that Eve was created second to Adam and responsible for original sin. They don't ordain women. They say they must be, quote, subservient to their husbands. And women are prohibited from serving as deacons, pastors, or chaplains in the military service. Because of all those things, Jimmy Carter is now no longer a Southern Baptist. He goes on to talk about the dangers of religion when it comes to women, quoting from a lot of Islamic beliefs.
The two are just not comparable.
No,
oh,
like,
my gosh. Don, I am so tired of people. And I think sometimes people try to do it influentially. It's like, okay, President Jimmy Carter is leaving, so we should change because it makes a big deal when he steps away.
Well, not only
right?
people. Let me just break in there. Sorry to break in, but he says that you should follow me because I am part of something called the elders. This is his argument. I'm part of something called the elders, which apparently, I had not heard of this, I had to Google it, is a group of leaders in the world. And just as a little side note, Timory, many more men than women are a part of the elders. I'm just saying, just putting that out there.
Are you trying to ruffle my feathers
No,
over
I'm
here?
Not. I'm trying to question Jimmy Carter's. So he says, don't listen to all of these religious leaders, do listen to me because I'm part of the elders. And if you just followed us, we have the blueprint.
So what are the elders exactly?
For humanity. It's this group of people that offer you advice about what to believe and how to live. Yeah.
Well, and you know, here he is just taking some of his arguments. He complains essentially about women needing to submit to their husbands. Well, if you read Ephesians chapter 5 and some of the other texts talking about the submission of women, first break down the word submission, under a mission. Wives, be submissive to your husbands as Christ lays down his life for the church. We are called to be under a mission together, so much so that we're in union. We're overcoming our self-desires, our own paths, and only our motivations, and we come together. So much so that that mission is together, that the husband should lay down his life for that mission of pursuing holiness together in every part of life.
Yeah, and I cannot imagine that Jimmy Carter would not have been made aware of that teaching. The Southern Baptist teaching on marriage equality, as far as I understand it, and I wasn't a Southern Baptist, but I spent a lot of years in the evangelical world. It's not much different than the Catholic view that you're right, we're in a mission together. It's not that one is not equal to. It's that we have roles to play and we're husbands. Yeah, it's exactly. All of that stuff. It makes me question a couple things. Did the Southern Baptists suddenly change their teaching after 60 years that Jimmy Carter now suddenly has to leave? Was there some new revelation, some new prophet that they brought forward that they changed? I don't think that's the case. And two, is it just his interpretation then of their particular thing? And three, let me throw a third one out there. On what basis does Jimmy Carter choose religions? Like, on what basis should anybody choose a religion? Do we just shop around and look for a religion that we like, you know, that matches up with what we think the world should be like or that we find comfortable? It's sort of like shopping around for something that meets our needs and desires. Yeah. This seems to be the way that Jimmy Carter is treating religion.
Well, and this is the challenge right now, is that instead of pursuing truth in religion, we're pursuing essentially, we're distorting the human person so that the person's not true to themselves. And in the name of love, we are saying, my truth is my truth, and you need to change with what I believe is true. But we're throwing love on there to somehow make it sound Christian and sympathetic.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're exactly right. What he's doing is presenting his own religion.
Yes.
I'm just making up a set of beliefs on my own. Mm-hmm. And I think you should believe them because it's loving, whatever that
exactly
means. But yeah, it's absolutely him just making stuff up and deciding, well, this is what I want to believe.
Yes.
Guess what? That's not how the universe works. That's not how reality works. We need to discover what's true and then submit ourselves, conform ourselves to reality if we want to live a flourishing life.
Exactly. I mean, even just looking at his argument, so you mentioned the submission one, and then he also claims that women are being degraded based on the fact that it's primarily male hierarchy in the church. Well, look at it from the perspective of the Catholic Church or some of the Orthodox churches that follow similarly. Well, Jesus had 12 apostles. Those 12 apostles were all men. He was calling them to be spiritual fathers. I'm sorry, only men can be fathers. Only men. But right
what?
Now,
Timory. Oh,
but right now, right? Right now, right now, that's offensive to say. How can you say that only a man can be a father?
Yeah.
Well, it's ingrained in his biology, his chemistry, and his chromosomal self-knowledge of who he is.
Yeah. I think bottom line is the elders want us to accept their religion, and they're not willing to let us seek truth on its own merits. Hey, quick story before we close here. So the headline is babies floating in fluid-filled bags. And it's found, okay, the story is found in the Atlantic. I try to make that very clear because the first time I said this on air, I said something like this. Here's babies floating in fluid-filled bags in the Atlantic. And a listener and the producer, they're like, what are babies floating around in the Atlantic Ocean for?
Okay, you need to explain what's going on here.
No, the publication is the Atlantic, whereas no, there's no babies floating around in bags.
So
in
what's
the Atlantic
happening?
Okay, so interesting scientific development. As you know, Timory, dealing with preemies is a very real struggle.
Yes.
In medical circles, right? Mm-hmm. So babies are born prematurely. Many of them die. One of the reasons is that we have to try to hook them to respirators and forcing the air in those young lungs.
Even the lungs aren't developed yet.
Yeah, they're
yet
not developed.
Old.
And even if they do survive, they tend to have lung issues throughout life, right?
That's exactly why if you know you might have a baby prematurely, they push and push to try and wait as long as possible for the lungs to develop more.
Absolutely. Well, they've been doing experiments on lambs, premature baby lambs.
I saw that.
And what happens is they put them in a sack filled with amniotic fluid and feed the lambs through the umbilical cord. And so what happens then is the infant continues breathing, but through the umbilical cord, it doesn't have to breathe in air into the...
Yes.
And so you can develop the baby many more weeks. And they've actually had some success with lambs. And there's some great pictures here at the Atlantic of baby lambs growing in these clear sacks. And it's a pretty cool development. And I think it will help us have healthier babies in the future. What struck me about this coverage, though, is this paragraph in The Atlantic. If they ever materialize, artificial wombs may stir concerns among pro-choice advocates, since the devices could push the point of viability for human fetuses even lower. That might encourage even more states to curtail abortions after, say, 20 weeks gestation. Do they hear themselves, "I'm concerned that this may push the point of viability even lower. I'm concerned that babies may be able to survive at a younger age." That's what they're saying. What? Do they hear themselves? "Oh, I'm concerned that babies might be healthier. I'm concerned." Really? "I'm concerned. I suspect I'm also concerned that it may be more clear that the babies that are developing in a womb, if you can see inside of it, right? So clearly, like in these bags, that's clearly a baby." What is so sad about the Atlantic article is that they point out that, well, pro-choice people are concerned that, hey, we might be able to have these babies healthier younger. Whoa, really? Mm-hmm. That's your concern? That seems
it's disheartening to hear this. Incredibly sad
and maybe a little bit enlightening.
I think that it's great to hear sometimes these examples because it shows our inconsistency in thought in justifying abortion.
Right. In fact, one of the articles I read thought that these artificial wombs could spell the death knell for the abortion industry because it's so obvious. And I'm not sure that that's the case. That's wishful thinking, I think. But hey, anything that we can do to reduce abortions would be great. All right. You've been listening to Trending with Dawn and Timory. We'll see you next week.
This has been Trending with Dawn and Timory on Immaculate Heart Radio.
Trending.
To learn more about Dawn Johnson or Timory Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit dawnjohnsonministries.org or timory.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.